Welcome to Inquire, the Investor Relations podcast. I'm delighted to be launching our first series, which is in conversation with senior investor relations professionals in the UK. I'm Clara, and I'm the founder of Equitori, the investor communication consultancy. We help companies communicate their value to investors, working with some of the largest listed companies in the UK, Europe, and the Middle East, either alongside in-house IR professionals or as an outsourced IR function. And we also support companies looking to IPO and large private companies with their investor communication. For our first episode, I'm absolutely delighted to be joined by Helen Paris. Helen is a highly experienced investor relations director. She started her career on the buy side before moving into IR. Most recently, Helen was director of IR for G4S for 13 years. And Helen has also spent a number of years on the board of the Investor Relations Society in the UK. So she brings a huge amount of IR experience to the conversation today. So welcome, Helen, and thank you so much for joining me today.
You're very welcome. Thank you. Hello, everyone.
Great. So let's start with your career, Helen, because it's a fantastic career spanning years in both the buy side and IR. So just tell me a little bit about your career journey and how you ended up in investor relations.
Yeah, sure. So I did an accounting and finance degree. And in my year out, my sandwich year, I did a year with Courage, which is the pub firm. And during that time, I did a number of things in their different sort of accounting departments. And the bit that I enjoyed the most was working with the investment analyst. And his job was actually to decide which pubs they were going to invest in. This was sort of mid-80s. It was the time of the theme pub. So where are you going to make it, a family pub or a disco pub or a sports theme? And I really enjoyed the sort of going around looking at the different, different public houses, but also having to do the analysis around which ones to invest in, and then looking back and seeing which had been the investments. And so when I went back for my final year and talked to my personal tutor, I said, you know, you do realize you've been learning about this. We've been learning about Big Bang, the city was all about to happen in 1987, and you could have a job as an investment analyst working for a pension fund. So that's how I got into it. I was immediately put on the European equities side. So nothing in the UK, it was all outside of the UK. And I just really enjoyed, as I say, you know, meeting with different management, understanding the strategy, and then having to make a recommendation to the portfolio manager about whether we invested or not. And it was a really interesting time. There were lots of continental European IPOs. So a lot of the luxury goods companies like LVMH, L'Oreal, anyone that knows me would know I enjoyed all of that immensely. And it was also a time for a lot of the utility companies as well in Europe. So a really interesting time to be on the buy side. After a couple of years, I was approached to go to another portfolio manager, and that, I suppose, unsettled me. And I started looking around and I saw a job advertised for an investor relations analyst to work for Polygram, which at the time was the world's largest record company. And I have to say, at the age of 24, the thought of saying that I work for a record company rather than in the city was really attractive. And so I went to Polygram, and it was an absolutely fantastic time. They had just been listed on the New York and Amsterdam Stock Exchange. They were still majority owned by Philips. They bought Motown, Island Records, A&M Records, Def Jam, and they went into the film business and invested in companies like Working Title during the time that I was there. So a really, really fantastic first IR role.
That sounds like a highly coveted investor relations role. When you moved from the buy side into IR, I'm assuming you had a little bit of knowledge of what investor relations involved. Did it kind of meet your expectations initially?
I think that it was really interesting to be on the inside and to help develop the information, the materials, the communication. I must admit, the chief investment officer at the buy side firm that I was at was really disparaging when I moved and said, I don't know into IR. I never take any notice of them. I just want to meet management. And I think I've probably spent the last 30 years trying to prove him wrong. And so I think that it was just a really exciting time. It was for that business, it was the only sort of pure play listed music company. So although I was having to learn a lot, I was able to stay, I think, one step ahead of the investment community. And that's always what's a nice part about the job, is if you know more than who you're talking to. And so that was a bit of it that I really enjoyed. It was a great team. It was a, you know, very exciting time to be part of the business. And I found that because I did know people from the buy side, you know, sometimes I think people would say, oh, come on, Helen, you know what it's like. You know, we know why we need to ask these questions. But I do think that it gave me some sympathy for the questions that they needed to answer to make the decisions that we wanted them to make. And so I do think it's invaluable. I've spent so many years on the IR side, but I have also been on the sell side as well. So I've been on the spec sales side. And again, I think when you know that you have to pitch a company and an investment case very quickly, it helps you focus the mind and hopefully simplify the investment case to get through to your clients.
No, absolutely. And talk about some of your subsequent IR roles then, because you've moved around a few different sectors during your investor relations career. How did you find transitioning to a completely different sector?
Yeah, I left Polygram because I had a young family at that point and decided I was going to take some time out. It only actually ended up being around a year. And then I was asked to do some IR consulting for a cable TV company. I then went into the sell side. And during that time, I was asked to do the IR for EMI. And I went out as a consultant from the bank on the sell side to EMI. So a bit of an unusual situation. Then I went through 9/11, being on the broking side, which was quite tough for those people that can remember back 20 odd years ago. And I was thinking about what I was going to do next. I was ready to take, I guess, a step back up again. And so I was offered the role at BG Group. I was an IR manager, so I was going in below a head of IR, but an incredibly experienced IR, ex-corporate broker, Chris Lloyd. And it was a really, I suppose, traditional FTSE, ended up being a FTSE 5 company during my time there. And so I felt that being at Polygram had been a little bit more of the Wild West, you know, trying to sort of to learn things. It was Amsterdam listed, New York listed. This was a really more traditional UK FTSE company with brokers and things like that, which I hadn't had before. And it was a really nice company, great quality company, quarterly reporting. It all got a bit boring in 5 years and nothing really happened. We had to do a profit warning because our profits were going to be higher from one part of the business, a lot higher than the market was expecting. And I think we delisted from the New York Stock Exchange. That was it, basically. So I was starting again to, I guess, to move up to a head of role. And then I went to G4S. So then it's a case of, well, you be careful what you wish for. I think in our first week, we did a secondary placing. We sold our business in Germany. We sold our business in France. We bought a business that runs a number of the prisons and so on in the UK. And that was pretty much how it was for 13 years. You know, it was a really, really exciting time, but went through a number of challenges, partly because of the nature of the work that G4S did on security. You know, it always means it's going to attract attention. And there are parts of the media and parts of the general public who just believe that those sort of services shouldn't be with private companies. But it was really interesting business and, you know, 500,000 workforce, where these are people that, you know, basically protect people every day, day in, day out, and in over 100 countries. So it was a really interesting time. We went through a number of reputational challenges, clearly with things like the Olympics. We had an SFO investigation. We went through a major disposal program. We had management change. Pretty much most of the board changed when I was there. And I went through all of that working with the senior independent director. And I was very fortunate that the incoming chief executive had been my CFO at BG Group. So we already had a very good working relationship, which, you know, clearly at a time of a lot of change was really helpful.
You made a really interesting point earlier, actually, about choosing the right IR role, particularly for your personality and your mindset, is really important. And I've done a variety of different in-house investor relations roles, and I really agree with you that actually going somewhere that's doing things that's changing, that's going to present you with challenges, makes a big difference, both in terms of your sort of IR experience, the learning opportunities for you. And I think it's something that maybe sort of aspiring IR professionals should think quite carefully about before they switch roles, because there are some very stable IR roles, particularly if you're part of a larger team, and then some very unstable roles where you've got a huge amount of different experience that you're going to be exposed to as part of the role.
No, absolutely. I mean, I describe being at G4S as having three different jobs, really. The first few years was because they hadn't had anybody doing sort of full-time IR before, was putting in all the sort of systems and processes that you need for a proper IR program. We then had a number of years of, I guess, crisis IR. We'd had a failed bid for ISS, followed by the Olympics, all the sort of management and board changes. And then we had a period of new management and really setting out the new investment case. And obviously, you know, ultimately that led to the company being sold at a significant premium to what the first hostile bidder bid for us. But there were moments during my time at G4S where I sort of thought, well, I have been doing this a while. What else should I be doing now? And I was quite vocal about that. And I didn't want to move, as you say, for the sake of it. You know, I really liked the company, felt that there was a lot of opportunity in terms of the investment case going forward to see that be realized. And so that was how I ended up actually joining things like the IR Society. I thought, well, I'll go, you know, to learn that way and develop. I'll go through, I was very lucky to be asked to be on the First Deliver programme, and I then became a member of the education committee and then went on the board. Within G4S, I also spoke to my CFO and I ended up being a trustee for the G4S pension fund. And I do think that would be my advice to anybody that's in-house and is maybe getting a bit bored. It's just see what else there is that you can do within the company. And I would say something like to be a trustee, it sounds a bit boring, but actually it was really interesting. And obviously, because people have got a strong investment background, usually, or they've got an understanding, they definitely bring something. I mean, obviously, it varies depending on the investment decision process. But I just found that it was something really interesting. I was mixing with people within the business that I wouldn't have normally mixed with in terms of the employee representatives and so on. And so I felt that that was very interesting. I know of colleagues that have been involved in M&A projects. Obviously, it can be difficult because you can have very busy times. But I think if you do have some spare capacity, there's generally things that you can do internally that I'm sure would be very helpful. I also feel that you're only going to improve your capability as an IR if you have more understanding of things like treasury. Again, they can be quite dry subjects, tax, you know, just spend time, offer to go along to meetings, sit in on meetings. That would be my big advice really to anybody, is to say, can I just sit in on things? I think you do learn a lot that way.
That trustee point's actually a really interesting one. I've met with a couple of IR professionals recently who've been working with charities to be sort of on the boards and governors of schools and things like that, to get that sort of experience in a different environment, but sort of board level experience. But I've never come across sort of doing it within your own company, but that's actually such a fantastic logical idea.
It is. And it's quite interesting because I think that, you know, you have a very strong covenant to the pensioners in terms of what is in their best interests. And obviously, hopefully that's what you're doing in your IR role anyway. But there's obviously always, it can sometimes get a bit sticky between what the management team want, what your shareholders want, and what the trustees want. And so I do think it is a sort of fantastic opportunity really to sort of show your integrity and that you can make sure that you're doing things that are in the best decision for everybody really.
Yeah, fantastic. And you mentioned the IR Society, so that's a pretty good opportunity to talk a little bit more about your experience on the Investor Relations Society. So how did you originally sort of get into that position?
So I think it was because, as I say, I sort of took a conscious decision to do more things with the Society. So I was going along to some of their sort of courses and social events. And I think through that probably got to know John Dawson, who was the chair at the time. And then from there was invited to join the First Say Deliver programme. And I think a number of us on that programme then ended up being invited onto the board. And again, I guess I thought that it would be a useful experience to be a member of a board. At that time, I was sort of thinking about whether I was going to try and think about doing non-exec and so on. And being on the board of the IR Society gives you great experience. And clearly, through the last couple of years, hopefully, we've really helped the management team as well with the Society, you know, during unprecedented times. And I do think it's very good for IR people, as you say, to be a trustee or to be for a school or pension trustee or on a board, because a lot of what we do is very hands-on. You know, we just have to get on and do stuff. And being on the board really makes you have to sort of sit back. You know, much as we'd all like to get on and tell them to do it and do it ourselves, you have to sort of take a step back and motivate, encourage, advise. And I think those are really good skills to develop. Earlier in my career, and people would say, you know, you need to be more strategic. I honestly don't really think I knew what that meant, but that sort of ability to be able to sort of take a step back and really sort of think about what you're doing and why we're doing it, I think is invaluable.
And you also sat on the education committee, because something at Qatori we're encouraging all of our sort of junior associates to do is these certificates in investor relations, which gives a really good sort of theoretical foundation in knowledge of IR. Is there any sort of qualification you undertook as part of your career?
Because I did an accounting and finance degree, it gave me some exemption. So I did actually do things like the sort of CFA. It wasn't called that. It was basically the investment analyst exam. So it was like the first part of the CFA. I did those. I did registered representative qualification when I was on the sales side. So I do think those are skills and knowledge that you should be able to use in your everyday life and your private life. You know, I find a lot of stock market terminology, there's so much jargon. To just have a sort of an understanding of that and basic economics, I think is invaluable for everybody. So definitely I would advise everybody to take that qualification. I think that to really get some of the top IR roles, you probably need a very good financial background. And I think that's where, if you have any skills already or you have the ability to improve on that, that's definitely, you know, whenever I had people asking how they got into IR, that was usually the area that they were missing. There should be a real opportunity to improve on that.
Yeah. And I think, as you were saying earlier about having that credibility with the buy side, having that financial knowledge to sort of support the way in which you're answering their sometimes quite challenging questions, I think is absolutely key.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, they don't always get it right either. But if you've got an analyst that's got a really good, probably an accounting type background qualification and a marketing ability as well, then that's usually where they're the best. Basically, that's usually what the top ones have, the top rated ones have.
And coming back to some of your board experience, when you were the director of IR at G4S, how regularly were you interacting with the board? Did you have the opportunity to attend board meetings and present at those meetings?
Yes. Yeah, so my main interaction was that I present the investor relations report. So the board probably met on average, usually around sort of 7 or 8 times a year. And I would present at probably about 4 of those. So around, you know, after the sort of full year results, half year results, strategy presentations. Sometimes if they were running short of time, they would sort of say, oh, everybody's read the paper, and I would move on. But I was there. Even if I didn't present, I was in the room. So I found that invaluable. Clearly, when we were going through the takeover and through any of the other sort of major actions with that happened, corporate actions within the group, then I would be involved in all of those meetings. And the other thing that I did that's invaluable, that hopefully is something that other people can use as well, is that we had an annual board strategy presentation, which was usually a 2-day affair, often overseas, where each of the regional directors would present, you know, their sort of opportunities and the 5-year plan, and that would then be rolled up into the group plan and the budget and so on going forward. And I was always part of that. And that's something that I know sometimes it can be very difficult to get yourself in on those type of events, but those were invaluable to hear the discussions about what they were thinking, and clearly to hear some of the opportunities were coming up on a sort of a 3-to-5-year level as well, and provided a lot of information that we could then use for things like our strategy presentations, our annual reports, and so on. G4S was a bit unusual in that we didn't have a sort of a head of strategy. So I think it meant that myself and our executive assistant ended up probably doing more of that type of work than we would have done, say, when I was at BG Group. But I still think that there is an opportunity to try and get involved in those sorts of meetings. And then obviously we would do the normal governance type roadshow meetings as well, as because of the number of issues that G4S had, that, you know, they were quite often, to be honest, on the ESG and with the chairman. And those are things that, yeah, I found very useful. REM, all of those, the normal sort of governance meetings.
No, absolutely. I agree on the strategy side as well. I always push quite heavily in-house to have a seat at the sort of strategy presentations internally, because it's really interesting just to hear where the sort of direction of travel is, even if it's longer term, because it does inform those conversations you're having with investors. So I think that's an excellent recommendation.
And also, I think sometimes, you know, companies have choices around capital allocation. So to understand about the reason, you know, for example, how we got to selling the G4S cash business, you know, the blue G4S cash, you know, vans that you see driving around, we sold the majority of that business. You know, the process that we went through meant that I could, with hand on heart, talk about, you know, a really thorough process that we had gone through, and that looking at all the different options for how much we were going to sell, whether we sold the technology business as well. You know, those, as I think, it just gives you a lot more confidence when you're talking about those sorts of issues.
Absolutely. Was there anything on the other way around did you do to sort of promote the role of investor relations internally within the business?
Yes, it was a little bit of a battle sometimes, I must admit. When I was at BG, there was 5,000 employees, all of who pretty much held shares or some sort of share equivalent through ShareSave scheme. And so it meant people were really self-interested and were very helpful most of the time in terms of providing information. At G4S, it was much more concentrated. And we really tried to sort of to help by saying, look, this is probably the only corporate information that we had because the annual report, CSR report, and so on. So we really tried to sort of to sell it as a way of, look, if you can help us with this, we're providing you with material to help you win business that's going to be good for your business. You know, let us help promote your business. You don't maybe have a big marketing budget. It's very much a B2B business. So let us help promote your business. I did try and take some of the regional MDs on the road. Sometimes, you know, there's politics involved in trying to do that. And then they really understood why they were being asked the questions they were being asked to deliver on. And I also tended to, I really hopefully sort of was a mentor for a number of the Fight Group Finance team. So I would often, particularly when I was doing things like the private client sort of PCB type meetings, most of the time I was on my own. So I would take somebody with me from Treasury, from Group Finance, just to often to sit in. I'd often take Group Financial Controller if he had the time, so that again, he could understand why the questions that, you know, I was asking and, you know, putting in materials were there. So that way I did. To be fair, the management team, they very much put IR, you know, very, you know, front and central. They understood that company belonged to the shareholders. And I think that's partly why I was given the access that I was to them and to the board.
And I think that's a really, particularly using this annual report as a part source of marketing tool, that's a fantastic idea, actually, because so much work goes into the document and it is such a wide audience you're addressing through the document. But I've never really thought of it that way. So I think that's a fantastic tip.
And, you know, we found, particularly with sort of with ESG, that with the bids that we were having to do, you know, for big sort of, you know, major corporates, there's obviously, they have concerns around their supply chain. And so for us to provide all of this sort of ESG type information to them, we could say, well, here you go. You know, here's the double page spread of all the data that's in the annual report. You know, so I think over time they did get it, but I'd say it took a few years.
And just on the subject of ESG, I noticed you won an award back in 2019. So kind of quite early days for the sort of ESG narrative to be coming through in your materials. Is there anything, any colour you can give around that?
I suppose fundamentally we felt that G4S was securing your world in terms of providing security for airports, buildings, you know, number of facilities. And so felt very strongly, but also recognised that there were certain areas where we faced challenges and where we needed to really explain in more detail about what we did, but also be clear that other areas that just wasn't really, we weren't going to have a big impact. So I think we had to be quite disciplined about that and quite firm around the areas that we were really going to focus on. But ultimately, I think what we also did was we thought about ESG as part of our corporate strategy in the same way that we would with anything else. So we sort of thought about, you know, who are our key stakeholders? What were our key metrics? What were the key risks, key opportunities? And what were the sort of the key performance indicators and what were going to be our aims going forward? And so, you know, where we had a double page spread for the group strategy from a sort of, I suppose, a business perspective, we then had exactly the same for a business point of view from more with all the ESG metrics. And I think that's, to be honest, what won the award. And that gave us then a template going forward to think about how we were approaching things. But I would say it's still very much, you know, a journey that the group is on because of the sheer scale of the organization. We're probably still today in close to 100 countries and have multiple businesses in each country. So really to focus on the areas where there is the greatest impact. But yeah, I think we were especially proud of that award because it was at a time when there were panorama programs about G4S. So it wasn't as though everything was fine and dandy. There were challenges and we were being very open and discussing those as well. So we did have the challenging case studies that were going on were also in our CSR part of our annual report and in the CSR committee talking about Birmingham prison, things like that.
Did you see a shift in terms of how the buy side were engaging with these issues towards the last couple of years or so?
I think yes, to some extent. I feel that the type of company that G4S was meant that some of the funds just would not invest. to start with. So I think that there were definitely opportunities. There could have potentially have been opportunities there. Obviously, those have gone now. The company's been acquired. But I think that, you know, it's quite a big, complicated company. And really, unless, you know, you really needed quite a lot of resource to understand what the group did. And so this was another layer of complexity as well. I found that some of our largest US funds still didn't really go into amount of detail that I would have expected. And I think that we did see a level of engagement with more senior people on the buy side than we would have seen, you know, maybe sort of 5-10 years ago, where it would have been, you know, an ESG analyst. This was the sort of portfolio manager. So I'd say that there were a couple of areas where people were very involved, but I'm sad to say, I just think also people just felt, oh, here we go again, it's the media or about GFRS, and they ignored it. It became white noise to some extent, which isn't good really, but I think that was also where we probably didn't get some of the attention that other companies may have done, because we've been through a number of issues in the past. It's just another skeleton coming out of the cupboard.
Is there anything strategically you did to try and sort of pique interest then amongst the broader investor base while you had those challenges ongoing?
So it was obviously continuous engagement. We made sure that we're very proactive when issues happened to explain what had gone on. One of the best things that we did was we offered to any fund, any investor anywhere in the world to come and visit our facilities. Took us up on visiting prisons in Birmingham and those that did absolutely transformed their view about what we did, about the people that worked for us, and became interested in prisons and rehabilitation on an ongoing basis. So firms such as Hermes, that I would have said were quite negative towards G4S, came along and then after that used us as best examples, best practice examples of engagement and communication in their own materials. And so I'm not saying it's not without some trepidation that you do those visits, but we were also very touched. You know, we would say, we'll come with you if you want us to. We won't come with you if you don't want us to, you know. So that way, I'd say we've definitely helped to change people's minds about things. But issues around having migrant workers in the Middle East, you know, these are also quite complicated discussions. And so sometimes as well, we would engage with the buy side to say, you know, what are other companies doing on this? We know they're employing people. What are they saying? Why are they not being targeted in the same way as we are? And so we had a few that were sort of helping us on that side as well, because they could see that there was upside in terms of changing people's view on the group from an ESG perspective as well.
You got any tips for IR sort of individuals who are going to host a site visit? Because when I'm in-house, it always made me quite nervous, particularly the idea of an investor going unaccompanied to one of our sites. I always felt that's quite a lot of briefing and preparation required for the individual showing them around the facility. Any sort of tips or learning points maybe from some of your site visits?
Well, obviously, it's key to have really good people on the ground that can help with the logistics, because when I was at BG, we did site visits to Kazakhstan, to Egypt, to Trinidad, to Lake Charles. So you want to make sure that, you know, people are obviously safe and things on the logistics side, because there were some fantastic examples where it didn't go right with some of our competitors. So clearly you have to have a really good team on the ground. I think that you, obviously, you yourself have to make sure that you visit and do a good sort of recce. And I just think you have to think about all the questions that people can ask. Realistically, you know, for example, to a prison, there is very little that they can learn from, say, a price sensitive perspective, but it really gives them an insight and almost a unique opportunity to, you know, to see a part of society that very people hopefully, you know, have access to, really. So I think it depends what it is. I know when we did the site visit to Egypt when I was at BG Group, we were very much ahead of schedule with the project there, which was to bring on a next train of liquefied gas. And we didn't want to tell the market because we just, you know, there was still some time to go. We needed to sort of just make sure that we were going to under promise and over deliver. But I remember we were in a coach driving into the facility and someone had put a massive billboard saying, you know, 6 months ahead of schedule. But luckily, everyone was looking at the other side. I think I'm looking at a mile or something.
Oh, my goodness.
So, you know, that was unique. I think you've got to expect that things are probably, you know, not going to go smoothly. I mean, I'm not sure how many of those things happen now, and particularly in the time of sort of COVID and traveling and so on. but I do think it's very useful. One of the things that I did do at G4S, where we got the most positive feedback and where the analysts talked about for a number of years and still probably, is that G4S used to have a leadership program where the top 30 individuals around the organization, sort of future leaders who would be the future regional CEOs, CFOs, potentially even group level, were put on a development program. And they would come to London every so often. And I think it was probably a 2 or 3 year program that they were on. And we made sure that we coincided one of those with our group strategy presentation. So we did a group strategy in the day. And then in the evening, we organized a dinner where we basically had 4 G4S people and 2 analysts on each table. And it was a sort of social, but very much, you know, the opportunity for people to talk about their own bit of the business. And so, again, I suppose the risk is limited in that they could talk with a lot of knowledge about their piece, but at a group level, that was going to be relatively small. And I remember sort of the analyst saying that to have it being sort of 4 to 2 was the other way around. Normally, if they were going to do anything with a company, it would be, you know, 20 analysts for 1 manager. So the ratio was really, really positive. We sort of moved them around and so on. But also said, you know, these are people that were obviously could see a lot of opportunity with the group and therefore were very enthusiastic and positive. And I remember one of them saying, wow, you know, if you could bottle that enthusiasm, that you'd make a lot of money. And so if there are those sorts of opportunities, as I said, that was something that was I think, quite innovative and was seen as really positive.
Yeah, I think that's something that's lacking with virtual capital markets events is, I mean, on the plus side, it's very controlled. You can pre-record, you can script everyone, so you know you're kind of safe from a disclosure perspective, but you do miss sort of lack that interaction. And something we're encouraging our clients to do, which is maybe safer while we're sort of navigating through the pandemic, is sort of smaller roundtable dinners. So even with the top sort of fund managers or a handful of sort of sell side analysts, you get that sort of exposure to the management team, but it's a slightly smaller, safer environment, which is a bit more COVID friendly currently. And that format works really well.
Yeah, we've done that sort of thing in the past. And I agree. I think that does work really well. And they get to see the management team in a bit more of an informal environment as well. So it does work well, definitely. Obviously, they have the right clients, but it can work very well.
Good. And when you're in-house, any tips in terms of how you sort of stayed on top of trends from an IR perspective?
I think it is one of the biggest challenges is to continue to sort of to keep, you know, on top of everything. So I would try to be open to see people, to hear, you know, to sort of from suppliers about what was happening, be prepared to try things, do trial runs of things. I did speak to other peers. Sometimes it's easier to speak to people that are in your own sector and that you saw. I'd ask particularly the house analysts, you know, who else did things well. I found that particularly when we were trying to get across key messages, you know, either going through a transformation and so on, that's where the brokers were very helpful, that they could go across the whole industry, you know, across all multi-sectors to give examples of companies that were providing that. That was really one of the reasons for joining society as well. It meant I had to stay on, you know, on top of what was happening in terms of changes in regulation and so on, to be able to talk a bit more knowledgeably. But yeah, I think it's, you know, when you're firefighting a lot of the time, that is quite hard. You know, it's always the temptation is just to carry on doing what you've always done. But I guess where we've had so much change, we had, you know, changes in CEO, CFO, chairman as well, that does also make you take a step back and think about what you could be doing differently. And clearly you look at what the companies that other companies that your chairman is the chairman of, your CEO is a non-exec of, you know, all of those sorts of things. So our CEO was audit chair of Schroders. So we used to always look at what Schroders did in their annual report, you know, things like that. You know, you should look more widely if you can. And I do think, you know, use your brokers for some of that type of information.
No, it's a fantastic tips. I think the peer-to-peer learning is a great point as well. There was a really nice conference I attended last year. It was a sort of investor relations sort of focus conference, and it was all virtual, but they had breakout sessions. So you could request within your sector to have a sort of 20-minute Zoom chat with someone, another head of IR in Europe in a similar sector. And it was actually really, really nice because these were individuals you didn't normally sort of typically get to meet face-to-face, but it was nice to kind of just have that informal chat and share learnings.
I must admit, the most calls that I had from any sell-side analyst that moved into IR was about things like IR databases, you know, so yourself, your register analysis, your brokers, you know, it was all of that type of stuff.
Yeah, it's a challenging transition actually from the sell side into to IR, because while you know the role, you know the interaction with the buy side, there's that huge amount of process that goes alongside running a sort of effective IR function. And that I think maybe the sell side don't always appreciate the sort of administration side of the role as well. And actually exactly getting good tips on databases and things like that will help you run a more efficient function over time.
I think for a few of them, it's been quite a shock, but as you say, about the process and the number of drafts and things that you do. And it's interesting because there was obviously a real trend, particularly in the support services sector that I was in, I'd say back sort of 5 or 6 years ago, of people moving from the sell side into IR. And that seems to have stopped more recently, which is probably because there's been a lot of IPOs and so on. It's probably become more attractive to stay in on the sell side, or people have just, it's not been for them, I guess. Yeah.
And just on sort of IR as a career and a profession, any recommendations for someone looking to start their career in investor relations, or any sort of mistakes, I suppose, that you wish you hadn't made as you embarked on your early stage career in investor relations, which you could share with those individuals?
I mean, I do think it's, you know, a fantastic job. I was always sort of had quite a strong sort of maths background, which is why I did accounting and finance. But I think to be able to then combine that with the communication and the talking side is what makes it quite unique. You know, that's why I really enjoyed it, and why, you know, although, you know, I went onto the sell side for a while, I went back into IR. I think it's also absolutely, apart from maybe being on the buy side, it's quite unique in terms of the access that you have to the most senior people within the organization. I think that's a real privilege, really. You know, and I think I've worked with some of the top CEOs, you know, in the world, really, when I think about, you know, world-class people and chairmen and so on. So that side of it, I think, is unique. I guess if I think back to when I joined Polygram, I wish I was a bit braver, but you're just not really, or I wasn't at 24. So I just think if I had pushed more and been involved in more things, and that's why I would sort of say to people, you know, if there is an opportunity to, you know, be a bit pushy, use those elbows really to try and sit in on meetings and things, because often I think everybody just gets into that sort of routine and the hamster wheel of reporting and so on to try and continue to develop. But no, generally I'm pretty happy with how it went, really. I've enjoyed it. It's never been boring, that's for sure.
I think those tips around the internal network are absolutely key though. And I think the advice you gave earlier about it's a give and take as well. It's very one-way dialogue where you're going to them, constantly asking questions for information. So making sure you're making it relevant to them and, you know, why you're here and what role you play within the organisation is really helpful. And we used to do lunch and learns when I was at ITV, which were great to help people understand the role of investor relations.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And that's something that we used to do at VG as well. So do those types of events. The other thing that I would say, and I do think it is really a really good trend, as partly as a result of MiFID II, is that I do think that there was always too much disintermediation really between the IR and the buy side through the sort of, you know, I recognize the sell side and the brokers do a really good job, but I often would be frustrated thinking, I know this investor is ringing all these analysts up. Why doesn't he just ring me straight, you know, and ask me himself, you know, where's it she? You know, so, and I do think that through some of the challenges that G4S had, the fact that we had direct relationships with some of our largest shareholders meant that I could ring them up, or vice versa, to have sometimes quite uncomfortable discussions around things, and that we had that sort of relationship. And that doesn't obviously happen overnight. But I do think to get feedback from your shareholders, to be in regular dialogue, and I know sometimes, and some people, you know, do all their own meetings and so on. I do think that although it's very time consuming, you are getting probably snippets of information that are lost when you're going through a third party.
I absolutely agree with that. And something I always recommend heads of IR do is pick up the phone quite soon after the meeting, because there's always going to be a question that wasn't quite answered fully, or you said you go back to them on. And just by picking up the phone, you kind of have the opportunity then to get a little bit of feedback and gauge a little bit better how the meeting had gone. And that those little snippets of information, even if it's just a 2-minute conversation, are really helpful when it comes to sort of informing your sort of perspective on their perceptions of the business.
And similarly, I think that I can remember sort of speaking to one of our largest shareholders at the time to really try and understand why they were investing in us. You know, I mean, I knew why I thought, but it was really interesting to hear them, how they talked about our business. And so I do think there is also, if you are having those discussions and that dialogue, to just to listen about what they're saying. You know, this, I remember this guy saying, look, we see you in a structural growth business and you're a growth compounder and compared us to other companies. Well, I would have agreed with him, but I wouldn't have probably used those words before. So, you know, I'll use them going forward. So just to try and say, have that interaction as well. I think it's particularly on a roadshow, it's very easy to just think, oh, here we go. Right, off we go and launch into your presentation, to actually try and have that discussion to understand what it is that they really are looking for.
Brilliant. And just as we start to sort of wrap up, thinking back over your super impressive career, what's been the most enjoyable? What's been the best part about being involved in investor relations for so long?
I guess it's always going to be down to the people, isn't it? It's the people that you work with, the people that you've met over the time. You know, one of my house analysts at Citi was the analyst when I was at Polygram. So, you know, I'd known sort of over 30 years. And so, you know, some of these people you sort of feel like you've grown up together. You know, that's how, you know, working with people, say at G4S for a long time, at Polygram, you know, it's a cliche, but you do feel like they're sort of, you know, family in some ways. So it would be that when you're right in the midst of it, of an absolute crisis, it all feels quite tough. But, you know, afterwards, you can sort of have a laugh and sort of relax about it. So I think that's the only way that you get through. I would say, you know, there's probably about three or four of us at G4S that we massively relied on each other to get through some really tricky times. And so, yeah, that will be with me forever, definitely.
Fantastic. And is there anything you'd like to ask me or anything else you'd like to say before we wrap up?
I must admit, your question, which was, what is the biggest challenge investor relations is facing today? I think it's the same challenge as it's always been, really, which is around getting people's attention, is making sure that if you're relevant or if you're in a cyclical stock. And so I was interested what you would think that was.
In terms of challenges, I think there's the internal challenge, particularly in a virtual environment, of having a presence, particularly having a presence with the board, informing the importance of the role of investor relations with the board. I think that's a challenge, particularly for some of the sort of smaller and mid-cap heads of investor relations that I work alongside. And then I think it's always ensuring you're accessing the marginal buyer, and actually, you know, you might have 2 to 3 brokers who are engaging with sort of their institutional audiences, and particularly, you know, even with sort of conferences now, particularly conferences in a virtual format, it's very much the same sort of sequence of investors that we tend to see at these events.
The question
is always, who are we not seeing and who are we missing from our investor marketing strategy? And there's sort of obviously multiple audiences and great ways to engage with sort of more sort of family offices and private client brokers and retail investors now in virtual formats. But it's always kind of that question, who have we missed in our investors and targeting? So Helen, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been absolutely fantastic to hear and learn from your insights and experience across an incredible career in investor relations. And for our listeners, please look out for the next episode of Inquire, the Investor Relations podcast.